one way, you will understand it too. In these words that I say, I'll close my eyes to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there, my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes and I'll see you with my heart.
And hello again. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And I know I say that every time, and every so often I think I should change what the show is about and say it some other way, but that says it all. Every week we have just wonderful people here involved in publishing in some way. So on and on. And today is December 21st, winter solstice, darkest day of the year. From here on out, it's going to be getting lighter again. So what a great day to be here. Today my guests are Michael Datcher and Francine Prose. First up is Michael Datcher. Michael is the author of the critically acclaimed New York Times bestseller Raising Fences, a Today Show Book Club Book of the Month pick. The film rights were optioned by actor Will Smith's Overbrook Productions, who hired Michael to write the screenplay. He is co-editor of Tough Love, The Life and Death of Tupac Shakur. Datcher's latest play, Silence, was commissioned and opened at the Getty Museum here in Los Angeles. He's appeared on both news programs Nightline and Dateline as an analyst and is a frequent commentator on BBC Radio. He is co-host of the weekly public affairs news magazine Beautiful Struggle on 90.7 FM KPFK. His writing has appeared in the Washington Post, LA Times, Baltimore Sun, The Source, Ladies Home Journal, Vibe, and many other publications. He's curated and or presented his work at the Brooklyn Museum of Art, Museum of Contemporary Art, the Hammer Museum, and other art institutions. He is editor of the New International Journal of Literary Nonfiction, The Truth About the Fact. Michael Datcher is a professor of English at Loyola Marymount University. Here he is. Hi, Michael.
How are you?
God, when do you find time to write?
Early in the morning. I'm an early bird writer, so I get up at 4:45 and kind of get myself focused. I meditate, and I live here on the beach here in Playa del Rey, so I get up, go out to the beach, and get myself ready to go inside, then I just write early in the morning before I talk to anyone.
Really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How long will you stay at the desk or stay wherever you're writing?
Well, I try to always get, I have a couple of writing periods. I have an early morning, a two-hour slot. I just spend 2 hours every morning. And then it depends on my teaching schedule for class, but I try to get another hour to two in sometime during the day. But always 2 hours in the morning after I've meditated and kind of read for an hour, then I really kind of get those 2 hours that are locked in, and then 1 or 2 hours in the rest of the day.
Have you always worked like that, or is it something you came to?
Well, I'm a busy guy. You know, I'm also heavily involved in social activism here in Los Angeles. There's a great need for help, essentially, in the South L.A. area. And so I've always been heavily involved in my old neighborhood, and I recently moved to the beach. And so given the fact that I'm a professor, I teach full-time, and I also involved in a couple of nonprofits, I've had to find a way where I could get up in the morning and not let the stressors of my life affect me. I mean, once my day begins, it is so insane. You can kind of tell with my schedule that you just read from my bio. Mm-hmm. Things are pretty intense. So I've got to get a time when I'm just not touched by the world yet, when it's just me and my spirit, and then trying to get that particular spirit on the page in the most authentic way possible.
Mm. Now, I have to say, I remember seeing you at, I don't know if it was at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books or the Hollywood Book Fair, one of the places that you've been, I heard you tell a story that was in Raising Fences.
Right.
And it was so intriguing. It was something having to do with your mother reading your book, and she said, you said you were raised in the barrio, and you said, I was raised in the barrio. Do you remember that story?
Yeah, my mother, who was a Southern woman, and like many folks from the South, is very concerned about appearances. And a part of Raising Fences is set during my childhood. It was a pretty rough neighborhood. And it's interesting how parents have a difficult time, understanding their children's lifestyles. As a working single mother, she was getting up and going to work every day and leaving the neighborhood. But I was entrenched in that particular environment. It was a pretty violent, crazy situation for any young person to be involved in. So for her, you know, she lived there. She went to work, came back home, and her life was indoors, whereas my life was in the neighborhood with the other young black men in that particular neighborhood. So it was a little different experience between my mother and my own life, you know, being raised in that neighborhood.
So how did you find your way to writing?
Well, my family is a family full of storytellers. My mother, again, is from the South. In that particular Southern black tradition, people eat and they tell stories in between chewing, you know. So I was always around storytellers as a kid, and I tried to, as a young man, to replicate the kind of, you know, the linguistic beauty of African-American speech patterns. But also as a progressive person who's heavily involved in politics, I wanted to also tell stories that dealt with the plight of African Americans and all folks who've been historically oppressed around the world. And so in trying to tell complicated stories, I wanted to do so in such a way that was also engaging. I find that many of us who are progressive at times allow our good hearts to get in the way of a well-told story. So my desire is always to first and foremost tell a great story, and then along the way incorporate important ideas in that particular narrative.
Well, it's so interesting. And your book, well, tell me about actually coming up with the idea and then taking it on.
Well, you know, this book is subtitled A Black Man's Love Story, and it is a love story, but it's a love story that is a love story for and written to black neighborhoods, a love story written to and for my black wife and my black mother, and it's a love story written to God, you know, trying to approach some type of a higher spirit. It's a love story about trying to embrace oneself, so a love story to the self. The idea began as a book of essays. I was going to write a book of essays about kind of politics and culture. I wanted to talk about fatherlessness, for example. In my neighborhood in Long Beach, we had a, I lived in a building with about 30 units, and there wasn't one father in this whole building. It was a bunch of single mothers, and I looked at the as a witness and also as a participant in that situation. I was privy to the impact of fatherlessness on young men and women, and I wanted to talk about that far-reaching, far-ranging, really quite destructive reality. So I was going to write a book really that kind of centered around fatherlessness. It was going to be a book of essays. I thought, well, in order to reach a wider audience, it's probably best that I find an interesting way to tell these stories. And what I pretty much came to was, telling my own story. I mean, I'm a fatherless person, so I kind of struggle with that because I didn't really want to put all my own life out there, to be honest. But the process began. I began to write this book, and it's really a memoir written as if it were a novel. So, and it deals with fatherlessness. It deals with black police relations. It deals with joblessness. It deals with all these kind of social issues that I tried to weave into my own personal story because that was my life coming up as a young black man in America. So I really wanted to both tell kind of an African American, a coming to age story, but also to show the beauty and the complexity of African Americans. Much of the work that I've read about black people in terms of literature, it oftentimes portrays black people as stick figures, very, very monochromatic, very, very narrowly drawn. But the folks who I knew were extremely complicated. I mean, the gangsters I knew, the hustlers I knew in my neighborhood were super bright, interesting people. So I wanted to kind of give people a sense, both black and non-black, a sense of the complicated nature of African Americans. So I felt like a part of why African Americans struggle so much in our country is that people don't really understand us. Because if you think about it, most non-black people don't really have African Americans in their lives in an intimate, meaningful way. And most non-black people encounter African Americans on the TV news with our hands behind our backs. So I wanted to give them, folks who don't really know blacks very well, access to this particular memoir. So I chose to use the memoir structure to tell my own story.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. I'm here today with Michael Datcher, author of Raising Fences. Did you worry at all as you wrote your book about exposing, your mother's life, the people that were close to you? Did you worry about that?
Absolutely. Are you kidding?
So how do you deal with it when you're writing a memoir and you have to be honest and put it all out there, and yet you worry about people being hurt or offended or exposed? What do you
Absolutely.
Do?
Absolutely. Well, I told the people who were in the book that I was going to tell the whole truth as far as I recalled it, and nothing but the truth. And if they couldn't deal with that, I would leave them out of the book. So, for example, my grandfather was in the book. So I sent an early draft of the book to my mother, which was a mistake. So if your listeners were writing memoirs, don't send any drafts to your family. The book is already on bookshelves. That's a little hint there.
And even then.
Right. So my mother called me crying and screaming and cursing at me, saying that I had disgraced her father's good name. So I said, I took him completely out of the book. So if I couldn't tell the whole story, what I essentially did was I just excised the person from the book completely.
Mm-hmm.
So very complicated, and luckily I was able to. I didn't have to excise someone who was critical to the basic telling of my story, which would have been very complicated.
Interesting.
Like my mother, for example, could have said, take me out of the book. It would have been a major problem in this book about a coming of age story about with no mommy. I mean, it's pretty difficult.
Well, read to us, will you?
Sure, I'd love to. This is really from just the second brief chapter in the book called The Spinners.
Okay.
I've been obsessed with being a husband and father since I was 7 years old. Quiet as it's kept, many young black men have the same obsession, picket fence dreams. a played out metaphor in the white community, but one still secretly riding the bench in black neighborhoods nationwide. When the picket fence motif was in vogue, only a few of us could get into the game. The swelling ranks of those who couldn't, the perpetual second team, were forced to the sidelines, scowling and pretending we didn't even want to play. The bastard children of these second teamers stalk the same sidelines. We rarely sit on the bench, too restless. We can't figure out if we want to beg to play picket fence or raise a stiff middle finger. Sometimes we do both, but usually we strike a cool pose, hide Huxtable family dreams in the corner. Can't let someone catch us hoping that hard. We know few people believe in us. We struggle to believe in ourselves, so we pose. We have gotten good. We can pose and cry at the same time. No one sees. We can pose and cry out for help. No one hears. We are the urban ventriloquists. Of the 30 families that lived in our Eastside Long Beach building in the mid-70s, I never saw a father living in a household. I never even saw one visit. But there were lots of boys in the neighborhood, Ricky, Dante, Pigpen, Kurt Rock. We rarely talked about our missing fathers. Instead, we poured our passion into our skateboards, our marbles, and our mothers. Yet the unspoken sparkled from our eyes whenever any neighborhood men showed us attention. Once in their gaze, we worked to outperform one another, trying our best to keep the man light from straying. Watch this. I can do a backflip off the curb. Hey, bet you a quarter I can make a shot from the free throw line. It's likely one of these men laid the seed that sprouted into a backflipper before them. Neighborhood rumors have a way of falling off grown-up kitchen tables and splattering on ghetto playgrounds. We flipped pop lock and did the robot for them, but we were knowing men weren't to be trusted. Even when our mothers didn't speak these words, their tired lives whispered the message. I knew many of these men had kids. Where were they? Why were they watching me spin instead of their own children? No, these men were not to be trusted. How could I accept their advice when their personal lives screamed, I'm lost too? There was too much fatherhood failure around. The disease seemed to be contagious given the epidemic in our neighborhood. These men could watch me spin, but I couldn't let one get close enough to breathe on me. Here's the ghetto irony. Many of my generation's young spinners have become the 20 and 30-something men who can't be trusted, making children who will grow up to hate them. Circumstance, suspect choices, and fear have ways of disfiguring urban hopes with surgical precision. A 4-ounce bottle of baby formula becomes much heavier than a 40-ounce bottle of malt liquor. Having 5 women becomes easier than having one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Michael Datcher reading from Raising Fences. You're such a moving writer. You know, your writing just really packs a punch. And as you were reading, I was thinking about who you were as a child. And you said earlier you wanted to be a husband and then you became a husband and a writer. And were you a real different kid? I mean, could you see those seeds kind of brewing early on?
No, part of the book mission is to let readers know that I really wasn't very different. You know, and that's part of the point of the book is that there are a lot of Michael Datchers out there. And I didn't have a gift at storytelling and writing, but for the most part, I was like any other neighborhood kid who loved basketball and loved to pick on girls and loved to tell stories and be with his boys and hang out. But a lot of those young men never make it out of the neighborhood to tell their stories. You know, they come to the public consciousness, Barbara, on the 11 o'clock news. You know, that's how they come into the public consciousness. And it's so important that people understand that I am not so unusual. I'm not so special. In fact, I'm quite ordinary in a way. You know, part of what I love about my current circle of friends, for example. So very few of my friends, only a couple. I only have a couple of my partners from my neighborhood who actually survived the neighborhood. One actually just became, it's an incredible story. He he just got a position as an ambassador to Canada, which is a crazy story in and of itself. But even my friends who are not from my neighborhood are typically black men, at least my African-American friends, black men who are working people, but who are, you know, who love their children, who are hardworking, and who are just good guys. And a part of this book's mission is to let people know about the full, rich complexity of the African-American male experience in particular.
Mm. Oh, yeah. We have a few minutes left with Michael, and never enough time. His book is Raising Fences. Did you, when you were a kid, was there a book or even a writer that influenced you?
Well, as a young man, and certainly in college, mm-hmm. I was very, very influenced by James Baldwin.
Oh, yes.
Because Baldwin was a guy, he used his own life as a springboard to talk about very complicated social and political issues. I mean, his books really are, his nonfiction, really, they're memoirs. I mean, he's just talking about his own life and using his life to talk about race and talk about oppression and talk about injustice. And what I loved about Baldwin is that Baldwin told the truth. You know, he really spoke truth to power. To be a openly gay black man in the 1950s speaking truth to power, let me tell you, that's my. In fact, on my desk right now, I have an office here. I have a home office here besides my office at school. There is a picture of James Baldwin, because James Baldwin is my man,
mm-hmm.
of course, because James Baldwin is a man of great courage, a man of great integrity, and a man who spoke truth to power. You know, we have this new international journal called The Truth About the Fact, which mm-hmm. is a Journal of Literary Nonfiction, and we call it The Truth About the Fact because it is all about the truth. I know it's really in vogue and among the postmodernists to say, well, truth doesn't exist. You know, well, I disagree with that. I'm talking about the lowercase truth. Everyone has their own personal truth to put forward into the world, and certain things certainly are about truth. Like justice is about truth. You know, kids having a chance to have a dream and survive childhood, that is a certain kind of a truth. I think James Baldwin for me represented people who were committed to trying to tell the truth to power, and he certainly is my most important inspiration in terms of writers. No doubt.
Yeah. You know, I need to have you back on, because a half hour just isn't enough time
to
cover everything I would love to cover. So let me just ask you in closing, if you have any words of wisdom for the writers who are listening, who may be struggling through a piece or through a book.
Well, I think really the foundational piece of advice is simply, you know, do some work on getting to know yourself. Again, I get up at 4:45 to write, but I begin that time. First, I read for an hour several spiritual books, and I go to the beach to meditate for an hour, and then I write. So I spend 2 hours basically kind of getting myself ready, kind of investigating my own spirit first, because all writing comes out of the self. If you don't really know yourself and you're trying to be a writer, good luck. So job one is to know thyself.
Mm. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Barbara.
You're quite welcome. That was Michael Datcher. He is author of Raising Fences, and he spoke to us from Los Angeles. When we return, we will be back with Francine Prose, whose recent book is called Reading Like a Writer. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama ache and tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Tari Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand, online at weeklysignals.com, or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
And you don't hear none of those stations playing them. Ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We were here the first half with Michael Datcher, author of Raising Fences, and we are back with Francine Prose. Before we bring her on, though, let me say that we are now podcasting. So if you go to my website, which is penonfire.com, click on the radio tower. That will take you to the radio page, at the top of which you will see directions for getting to the podcast. There's 100-plus shows up now, some old shows, some quite recent. This one will go up in another week or two. And just a wealth of listening pleasure and material that's there for you. Just anytime you want it, just download it and listen. So we are back, and we have Francine Prose with us again. She was here a couple years ago with The Lives of the Muses. She's author of 14 books of fiction, including most recently A Changed Man and Blue Angel, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. She taught literature and writing for more than 20 years at major universities such as Harvard, the University of Iowa, Columbia, Bard, the University of Arizona, and the New School. And her most recent book is Reading Like a Writer, A Guide for People Who Love Books and for Those Who Want to Write Them. published by HarperCollins. Hi, Francine.
Oh, hi.
Great to have you on, and what a wonderful book this is.
Thank you so much.
Gosh, you know, there books come out about books, you know, about reading, but there hasn't been a book like this for reading like a writer, where you're also giving instruction that is given in the most readable way. Would you talk a bit about how this book came to be?
Yeah, you know, in fact, that was sort of the amazing thing to me, that there wasn't another book like this, because I naturally, it was another one of these things that just seemed like, I mean, I hate to say it, but such a good idea that I couldn't believe that no one had come up with it. It came to me basically because I needed to write a lecture for somewhere, and I thought I would write about the way that I'd learned to write, which was by reading, just reading everything I could find. And then, you know, as I began to be a writer and think, and I think read like a writer, the way I read, which was taking things apart and looking at a piece of literature and saying, you know, how did Tolstoy do this, and how did Chekhov write the story? And I wrote this lecture, which was essentially about that and about how I really believe that it's a kind of better way to learn to write even than going to writing workshops. And I sent it to my agent just for her to see it, and she said, you know, I think this is a book. Mm. And that's how it happened.
Mm. That's wonderful when things unfold that way, isn't it?
I know, better than the opposite, which is planning and planning and planning, and then it doesn't work out anyhow.
And yet, you have published so very much. You've published just so many books of fiction. You've published books of nonfiction. You've published for young adults. You've published for children. So you don't seem to have a problem getting the words on the page.
You know what? I like to write. I mean, that I know, you know, which doesn't mean it's always easy, and doesn't mean I don't have terrible days, and doesn't mean I have weeks and months where I think, you know, there's this great William Burroughs phrase where he talks about the temptation to tear your work up into tiny little pieces and throw it into somebody else's garbage can. I mean, there are days like that, but I actually like to do it. I mean, I, you know, even if it's a book review or, I don't know, I just cut through sort of correcting papers for my daughter-in-law. I mean, you know, I just kind of like putting words on the paper.
Well, and as my husband said when I talked to him about this book and about you coming on the show, he said, with a last name like Prose, how can she not like to write? talk about these various chapters. You have chapter titles called Close Reading, Words, Narration, Dialogue, and Gesture, which is a most interesting chapter. How did you decide on the sections?
Well, I just went from sort of small to slightly larger. I mean, I thought the first chapter was basically words. I mean, it got rearranged later, but I just thought, okay, if I'm talking about reading word by word and looking at every word in a story or a novel, and, you know, I quote a friend of mine who has this great thing he says, which is when you're revising, you're supposed to put every word on trial for its life. First I would talk about words, and then sort of the natural progression seemed to be sentences. And then I thought paragraphs. And again, it was the sort of same thing. I thought, gee, how strange. No one has written a whole chapter about paragraphs. It's the most, you know, basic unit, really. So I wrote about paragraphs, and then I went on to do, what, narration, dialogue, gesture, you know, all the mm-hmm. things that you might want to think of in your life as a writer, but that also would occur to you as a reader to look at, and you know, I thought it might be helpful for people to see that.
Hmm. And then in gesture, I love this chapter too.
Well, you know, because often I think especially when writers are beginning to write, they think that the gesture is the same as just sort of creating a beat in a you know, that is, he picked up the cigarette, he lit the cigarette, she poured the glass of wine. And if it's used like that, your eye just skips over, you don't even pay attention. Whereas if you look at great writers and how they use gestures, I mean, there's this marvelous Turgenev novella, First Love, where he uses, it's all in gesture. And, you know, there's a Raymond Chandler story, kind of anecdote that I quote, you know, and this was, I guess, in the 40s when guys wore hats, and a guy is on the elevator with his wife, wearing a hat, and a pretty young woman gets on the elevator and he takes off his hat and the wife just looks at him. I thought, you know, that's a use of gesture. I mean, that's really where it kind of tells you something about a character or a relationship or you know, the sort of social manners or something. I mean, so, you know, the writers I looked at, every single, Philip Roth, I mean, there's a moment at the beginning of Goodbye Columbus where Neil, the main character, gets his soon-to-be girlfriend, Brenda, she asks him to hold her glasses when she goes in the pool. And that's it. It's there. That's it forever. So I just thought, you know, no one has really been looking at this, and it was so much fun to do.
Yeah, well, it's so much fun to read. And I'm talking with Francine Prose. Her new book is Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. And it's published by HarperCollins. Your chapter on dialogue is interesting. New writers especially seem to have a hard time with dialogue. They feel that they can't write it, or when they do write it, it's rather stiff. And of course, exercises getting them to listen to the way people talk and pay attention seem to help. But can you talk a bit about dialogue and the writing of it, and just give us a mini lecture on it?
Well, you know, I think everybody has an ear for dialogue. I mean, that is, you know, you listen, you talk, people are talking, and it's worth kind of just training yourself to pay attention. I mean, what are people saying? What are they saying on the surface? What are they really saying underneath? What do they want us to hear? What do they want us to not hear? And if you look at the really great dialogue writers, I found sort of a bunch from Henry Green, the British novelist, who's kind of my favorite, to Richard Price. I mean, always, there's just so many things going on, you know, again, on the subtext and just tons of subtext. You know, I mean, people are just trying to make an impression and to make someone pay attention to them and to seduce them and persuade them and all that stuff. The more you put in the dialogue, the more resonant and rich and interesting the dialogue will be.
You mentioned a word that mystifies new writers, and that is subtext.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Well, it is exactly what it is, subtext. What's going on underneath the text? I mean, someone is saying something on the surface, but what is that person really saying? What is, do you want me to read you this little thing about subtext?
That'd be great.
I was talking about how, you know, when students begin learning to write, they're told, you know, you can't write dialogue the way people actually talk. It's too full of hesitations and circumlocutions and blah, blah, blah. But my idea is that the dialogue you hear is a lot better than often what people try to write when they write, because it's so much richer. So here's just two paragraphs. Once I assigned a class to eavesdrop on strangers and transcribe the results, I decided to try it myself in a university coffee shop. Within moments, I overheard a young woman telling her male companion about a dream in which she saw Liza Minnelli arrayed in white robes and a starry crown, dressed as the Queen of Heaven. What made the conversation doubly engaging was that the girl seemed to be romantically attracted to her friend and was using her story as a means of seduction, unaware that he was, insofar as I could tell, gay. This fact was not unrelated to his lively interest in Liza Minnelli, yet another connection that his companion was preferring not to make. Like this one, most conversations involve a sort of sophisticated multitasking. When we humans speak, we are not merely communicating information, but attempting to make an impression and achieve a goal. And sometimes we're hoping to prevent the listener from noticing what we're not saying, which is often not merely a distracting, but we fear as audible as what we are saying. As a result, dialogue usually contains as much or even more subtext than it does text. More is going on under the surface than on it. One mark of bad written dialogue is that it is only doing one thing at most at once.
That's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, because dialogue needs to do so many things at once, or good dialogue does.
Yeah, and it reveals character. I mean, how, you know, if you just listen to how people tell their stories, and then you try and get that on the page, it's so, you know, it's not so much the story they're telling as the way in which they're narrating it. You know, their word choice, their emphasis, the way they order events.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Francine Prose, whose new book is Reading Like a Writer, published by HarperCollins. Narration is another hefty chapter here. as opposed to exposition or backstory, which seems to be very popular to include in the beginnings of stories and novels by new writers.
Yeah. Well, you know, the thing is, I mean, one of the things I take on in the book is the kind of, it's the things that young writers are often told in classes, and in writing classes, and I've never understood. I mean, I've never understood why, I mean, for example, the thing that's most kind of well-known and that everybody kind of laughs knowingly when you mention is the fact that students are often told that they're supposed to show and not tell.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I do in the book is, you know, look at all the great writers. I mean, Jane Austen and Melville and so forth, Fitzgerald, who are just telling you all the time. I mean, it's pure narration and pure exposition, and it's a good thing that nobody said to Jane Austen, you have to show everything.
Mm-hmm. I suppose does it depend on the type of book you're writing and sort of where you're setting it and what you hope to affect in the reader?
Sure. And every book is different. I mean, part of the fun and the pain and the challenge and the pleasure of writing a book is, you know, I know this sounds a little, but finding out the way it kind of wants to be told. I mean, do you use first or second or third person or past or present tense, or, you know, what kind of diction and what kind of word choice and high speak or low speaker, you know, what all those decisions go into making the book.
Mm-hmm. So when you're writing fiction, do you have a favorite person and tense that you like to write in?
It changes from book to book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a while, you know, I used to put down the present tense. I used to say, oh, I don't know, it's sort of gimmicky. And then I found myself writing three novels in the present tense, so go figure. And now, and also I was writing what I guess would be called very close third person, which is basically disguised first person. And now I'm writing something in the past tense in the first person. So, you know, it's just so different from book to book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And I guess that's the challenge of finding what's right for a particular book and messing around with different persons, different tenses until you find it.
Right, and again, you know, the value of going back and looking at something great that's been written. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, if you read the journals and letters of great writers, it's so encouraging because, you know, no matter what great geniuses they were, they also had their struggles. I mean, just in terms of narration, Dostoevsky started writing Crime and Punishment in the first person. And then I guess you can see in his journals when he realized that his main character was either unconscious or mad or raving or hallucinating, that was going to be kind of a problem for a first-person narrator. So he kind of recast it in a close third person.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. Well, what about voice? What about locating the voice of a character when you're writing fiction? Do you find that that just comes easily to you, or do you have to kind of futz here and there to find it?
Well, it's all about language for me. It's all about word choice. I mean, especially, again, if I'm writing in the close third person, so I'm really in the consciousness of a character, you know, what words does that person think in? What's the person's mental inner vocabulary? How does the person process information? And that, to me, is, you know, as important, or is the question of voice. But then, you know, one of the things that I talk about, a friend of mine said this remarkable thing, which was, you know, when people talk about voice, the question is always, who's talking, who's narrating, what's the voice of the narrator? But my friend said that really one of the questions is, the important questions is, who's listening? Who is the narrator telling this to? And I think that people don't realize that that's a problem. And then once you start thinking about it, you think, you know, am I directing this to the unseen audience or out into the ozone or telling someone that I care about and who is the narrator speaking to? When I started writing, the way I got around this was to write kind of old-fashioned frame stories where one character is telling another character the story. That's the story, you know, stories like the Kreutzer Sonata or the Turn of the Screw,
mm-hmm.
in which you know who's talking and you know who's listening. And that kind of solves for you the problem of who's listening, because the listener is right there on the page. You know exactly who's talking and who's listening.
Hmm. Interesting. So are you an outliner with your novels? Do you know from the start what's going to happen, and do you have it all plotted and outlined?
I wish I were. I write one sentence and then I write another sentence, and around halfway through I hope I have some idea of how the book is going to end. But, you know, I always say that I don't I don't suggest that anyone else write that way, because that's how you wind up with a lot of unfinished novels sitting in your drawer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you have an outline, at least you know where you're going. But I can't. I haven't been able to do that. So, you know, I get halfway through and I go, uh-oh.
So what pulls you through? Because obviously you make it work because you have more than a dozen novels published. So what pulls you through and allows you to discover what it is? I mean, are you at that point looking at, you're halfway through and you have developed characters and settings and all of that. Do you kind of decide what you've done and take it from there, or what happens? What is that process?
Well, you do get a kind of momentum. I mean, the first half is harder because you're kind of pushing uphill, and then
mm-hmm.
you can kind of coast after a while. But also, you know, you become engaged by the lives of the characters, and also the sheer fun of telling a story. I mean, especially when you begin to get some intimation of where the story is heading, and then it's just kind of this great roller coaster ride of the plot, just, you know, watching it go forward.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. We're here with Francine Prose, author of Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them, published by HarperCollins. I was curious about something that I wrote down that you said at the beginning. Oh, right, something about, you know, who needs writers. Well, I don't think you said it like this, but sort of like, who needs writers' workshops when you can?
I didn't say it like that.
No, you didn't say it like that.
I've had them in the past, and I still occasionally do it. No. I mean, I think that they're wonderful for certain things. I mean, they can teach you how to edit your own work, and they can also, they give you an audience. I mean, you know, because it's very hard, no matter how close you are to someone or how dear a friend is or you know, your spouse, that's a whole other issue, but, you know, to say to someone, would you mind reading my novel? I mean, whereas when you're in a class with someone, you're all kind of doing that for one another, so it formalizes that structure. And also people form connections, I mean, not connections in the kind of sleazy sense of connections, but friendships, really, and sustaining relationships in their lives, because it's a pretty lonely occupation. I mean, you're there by yourself with your computer. But I do think that reading is the most essential thing. I mean, the thing I can never understand is why someone would want to be a writer if they don't love to read. I mean, what exactly would be the payoff?
Mm-hmm. It's so true. Yeah.
Self-expression, maybe. I don't know.
Mm.
You know, the glamorous lifestyle, definitely not.
But, you know, there does seem to be an emphasis by new writers, especially on MFA programs, and feeling that if they don't get into a good one, then they have little hope of publishing or becoming the sort of writer that they want to be. And I see an awful lot of writers go through MFA programs and still they're not publishing. So you know, what would you say to them? Read,
well,
right.
You know, what I say to them and what I always keep saying to them is it's all about the work. It's
mm-hmm.
all about the work. I mean, you know, if you write a brilliant novel, whether you've gone through an MFA program or not, I think there's a reasonably good chance that novel might get published, as opposed to going through an MFA program and not writing such a good novel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's, you know, and it's not exactly as if they're, you know, just kind of feeding grounds for publishers, and it's a guarantee. I mean, that is one of the problems with it, is that it doesn't really guarantee you publication or another teaching job and so forth. But you know, as long as you can keep focused on the work and not be distracted by what your fellow students are doing, or you know, heaven forbid, your fellow student has gotten a 2-book deal from, you know, blah blah, and then you think, I never want to write again. You know, it's just important to just stay, you know, with your eyes on the most important thing.
Yeah. We have a few minutes left with Francine Prose, author of Reading Like a Writer. What are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? I'm reading Kafka's Letters. I just, for complicated reasons, I just picked it up and started reading it. I'm about to go on vacation, so I'll tell you what I'm bringing with me. I'm bringing Kafka's Letters. I'm bringing a book called Tête à Tête, which is about Simone de Beauvoir and Jean-Paul Sartre,
mm-hmm.
About their love affair. I don't know where this is heading. Maybe I'm thinking about writing something. I don't know what. and a novel that's coming out by a Chilean writer who's kind of my new favorite writer. He died about 3 years ago, named Roberto Bolaño, called The Savage Detectives. So those are the three books that I intend to get me through.
Now, do you, when you're working on a book, novel, nonfiction book, whatever, are you thinking about what the next one is, or are you completely through with the book and into promotion before you start working on a new project?
No, I've got a couple of ideas. I mean, I've just got, just vague ideas. I mean, ideas are, they don't mean anything. I mean, you have an idea and you think, oh, what a great idea, and then you start to write, and after about 3 days, you think, whatever gave me the idea that was a good idea. But I have a couple of kind of intimations. And also, I'm just beginning to talk. I have a new young adult novel coming out in the fall, and those are fun to write. I mean, those are just pure fun. And I've just begun to talk to my editor about writing another one. So that's something else I'm thinking about.
So, and so vague ideas could be anything like, oh, I don't know, I want to write a novel told by, with five point of view characters.
Exactly.
and set it in the Irish countryside.
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. Or, I want to write a novel about a painter.
Mm-hmm.
something like that. It's so vague.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I just thought with, as prolific as you are, that it came to you, in all its complete detail.
Again, I wish, if only.
Oh,
and you
dear.
Only had to write it down.
Yeah, yeah. We are at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any words of advice for the writers listening.
Well, one thing I always tell my students is, and it's sort of an odd thing to say, I guess, but if you can do anything else besides write, that is, if it makes you happy to do anything else, do that other thing. But if you can't not write, if you can't get through the day, if you just feel you can't possibly live without writing, that's the only reason, as far as I'm concerned, to become a writer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, good advice. Because all of that sitting, all of the gluing of the derriere to the chair.
As I say to them too, the world isn't saying, oh, goody, goody, another writer, let's make things easy for this person.
Right, right. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
And it's been great talking to you, and you've written another wonderful book, so thank you
so much.
That was Francine Prose, author of Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them, published by HarperCollins. And it's a different sort of instructional book, because it's really a great read whether you want to be a writer or not. But for the writers, it's just wonderful, wonderful examples in here, wonderful writing. And Prose herself is a great example of how to do it. We're at the end of our time again. And you can listen more if you like by going to Pen on Fire and clicking on the radio tower. And go to the archives. Lots and lots of material there for you to listen to. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Ernest Hemingway. I bought this little book Scribner's put out years and years ago. I think I was a member of the Quality Book Club, and it was one of the books I saw offered there. I've never seen this on any shelf of any bookstore, but it's a wonderful book called Ernest Hemingway on Writing, and it's just quotes by Hemingway on writing. And let me find one here. There's so many good ones that, let's see. Okay, here's one that was published in Byline. And he says, real seriousness in regard to writing being one of the two absolute necessities. The other, unfortunately, is talent. There's always that, huh? Talent. Anyway, I thank you for listening once again to Writers on Writing. And I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm author of Pen on Fire. And I will see you next time. Take care and have a wonderful, wonderful holiday. Bye-bye.